open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
I write the kind of books that it's often said you need to wait till certain people die before you can write the book.
Welcome to the National Writer Series on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Greg Iles says all of his books have one thing in common.
All my books essentially are an inquiry into the nature of evil. Whether I'm writing about the Holocaust or about the civil rights movement or whatever it is, my quest is to understand why good people do bad things, why bad people do good things, why the line between good and evil runs right down the middle of the human heart.
Greg Iles' latest book is Mississippi Blood. It's the third book in his Natchez Burning trilogy of thrillers. Greg began writing the trilogy while recovering from a traffic accident that almost killed him. I asked Greg to tell me more about Mississippi Blood.
On one level, it's a family story. One critic said, imagine Jim Finch grew up to learn things about Atticus no son should ever know about his father. So that's the family part. And then the epic background of the trilogy is based upon some real-life civil rights murders that happened in Faraday, Louisiana, 12 miles from where I live. Home of Jerry Lee Lewis, Jimmy Swaggart, and General Claire Chennault, if you want a little schizophrenic vibe. And those were investigated by a heroic reporter, a friend of mine, and he's a character in the books. He's Henry Sexton in the first book, and my father, Jerry Iles, is Tom Cage in the rest of the books. So these books intersect with reality, really, all the way through.
Yeah, I finished Mississippi Blood recently. I listened part of it on audiobook. Any of you in the audience, do you do audiobooks? Who does? Yeah? Greg's prose is so rhythmic, elegiac, and fine that it is an equally great experience to listen to this in the audio. I don't know if you've listened to your audio. Have you listened to your own audiobook?
No, I can't put myself through it. Sometimes I hate the narrators. Other times, the narrator of Mississippi Blood is good.
He's good. It's very good. And I was walking up at Hickory Meadows and you just knocked it out of the park. I think I texted you that rarely have I encountered a reading experience that had so much humanity and was about humanity and is about the struggle for people to be human in inhuman circumstances. And what's really doubly interesting as we approach Father's Day and so on is that I think it's really an homage to your father too, isn't it? And the values that he inculcated in you. Tell us a bit about Penn Cage, Tom Cage, and also Quentin Avery.
Okay. So my dad was a guy who grew up in a little Louisiana town, nothing town, and all he cared about was practicing medicine. He was one of those doctors you used to have in every little town that if you couldn't pay, he'd take a bucket of catfish or a mess of greens or whatever. He just wanted to take care of people. And the only other thing he cared about in life was books. Spent his whole life building a library. He's dead now, but if you walk in his house, there's the official records of the Union and Confederate armies, one whole wall down to things from, you know, just wonderful artifacts. And then guns, of course, Civil War muskets and all that. But what the book is about, and I got to talk to him before he passed away about what I was going to do. All of us in this room, you grow up for a while and you think your parents walk on water. That's just the way we are as kids. And then at some point, whether you're 4 years old or 14 or 40, you figure out that your parents have feet of clay at some point. And that's traumatic for everybody because for every kid, that's your sort of innermost bubble that protects you. And so that's what this book is really about. And I think it's why it resonated with people because Penn is a guy who grew up not only loving his father, but having a father everybody loved. And so to find out that he had an entire secret life is a shock to him. And I got to meet Pat Conroy the year before he died, and we talked a little bit. And the funny thing is that Pat spent his life writing about a father he wasn't ever sure loved him, didn't know how to show love, so he wrote in reaction to his father. Whereas I ended up writing in reaction to a father I knew loved me and that I loved. But even then, parent and child relations are complex enough. There's room for plenty of novels in there.
So Penn Cage is the often the narrator of the trilogy.
He's kind of a spectator, too much of a spectator almost, you know? I never wanted to write a series. He started in 1998 in The Quiet Game. which had a civil rights murder in it, but wasn't quite as brutal as this. Penn has always been a little too much of a Boy Scout for me, but as the books progressed, he's had to compromise those values and to fight the kind of evil that the books are about, and I'm glad of that. It's a relief. But when it comes to things like Hollywood, it's sort of weird because Penn isn't a Chris Hemsworth or something. He's a cerebral guy. He's watching and he's interacting in small ways. And then you ask about Quentin Avery. Quentin Avery, all I got to say is, you know, Morgan Freeman in a wheelchair. Quentin is
a cool guy.
Like so many guys in Mississippi, like after my accident, you know, I found out we got more amputated limbs in Mississippi than any state in the country. It's the only thing we're first in, right? Because we got more diabetes than anywhere in the country. So Quentin has lost both legs to diabetes. You can't even say he's on his last leg. He's past his last leg. But he's a guy who argued civil rights cases before the Supreme Court. And then in the 80s and 90s, to make a living, he, you know, took some drug cases and that kind of stuff. And his reputation got tarnished. But he's a genius in the courtroom. And it was fun writing about him.
Yeah, I mean, the Mississippi Blood is really a combination. First-person autobiography about the South. It's a great courtroom drama. I mean, I want to ask you a question. You're sitting on this stage built in 1892. We haven't had many writers from the South here. And so you're going to tell us some stuff tonight that we may not know about. We may dimly know about it, but you were telling me something backstage about the milieu which this book is set in. Why don't you tell us about Stanley Nelson? Tell us about the real backstory. I mean, what was this based on?
The real backstory of all this is this. I mean, I'm a thriller writer. Now they call me a real writer, whatever that is. I think I'm the same writer. I was always hesitant to write about the South fully and engage it. I knew a lot about it. I grew up in it. My mom grew up on a subsistence farm in Louisiana. Didn't have electricity till she was 14 years old. Picked cotton until she graduated from college. You talk about hillbilly elegy, man. That's poor, okay? So I knew about the South from them. They served in Germany after the war, and I knew a bit about that. And so when civil rights started to happen in the South, they knew a lot about the Holocaust, and they recognized a lot of similarities and things. But I always hesitated to write about it because I never wanted to play into the Northern stereotypes about the South. Because I'd meet people from the North and realize in the 90s and 2000s, they still think we got idiots running around in sheets down there, you know, the Klan, which is just ridiculous. If you know anything about history, I can tell you this, the Klan was effectively penetrated by 1966. Most of the Klan leaders were on the payroll of J. Edgar Hoover, literally. So I didn't want to use them as antagonists and take the easy road in a thriller. But then I got to know I got to know a guy named Stanley Nelson, who was a reporter in a little newspaper in Faraday, Louisiana, a lot smaller than this auditorium. Total subscribers, 4,700. And he started investigating some murders in his hometown, cold cases. And within 3 years, he had the FBI beating down his door begging him for information. He did more in 3 years than they did in 40 years. And what made it unique was Stanley. I know Jerry Mitchell, who like broke the Byron de la Beckwith case, the murder of Medgar Evers, and some of these guys. What made Stanley unique was he wasn't investigating the murder of heroes. He was investigating the murders of just regular black folks, a shoemaker, a busboy, who had been brutally murdered and left. Nobody ever saw the crime. And he uncovered this group. In the book, they're the Double Eagle Group. They're called the Silver Dollar Group. It was a bunch of Klansmen who knew the Klan had been penetrated. They formed their own splinter cell. They didn't have meetings. They didn't wear sheets. They each carried a silver dollar minted in the year of their birth. And all they did was beat people, burn people out, kill people, and not one was arrested for 40 years. Now, Stanley covered that for about 7-8 years and ended up only losing the Pulitzer Prize to the Spotlight team that broke the Boston church scandal.
In a town at Faraday, with 4,000 circulation.
Yeah, 4,000 circulation. So if there's journalism still alive, that's it. And so I knew finally that was a story I got to write about this. You know, it was worth exploring it. So that became the background, and the family became the foreground. But what made it unique was that after the accident, after nearly dying.
That was in 2011?
2011. I tried to write it as one book, and I'd gotten up to 600-700 pages, and I realized this is not going to happen. And your publisher does not want to hear that, I'm telling you. I was on the hamster wheel of, you know, my last book had been number one in paperback. I was getting cocky, you know. I mean, I was cautious for a long time, and then by then I'm like, hey, I'm somebody, you know. They paid me a whole lot of money, and then I pulled out on 61 a week from deadline and didn't just tear my aorta and take my leg off, but crushed this whole leg, my pelvis, my ribs, my arm, everything. They said I had a 1% chance of survival. So when I came out of that, I just looked at the whole thing. I just threw away the commercial imperative. I just stopped worrying about it. I said, if I'm going to write about family and race and America and the South, I don't have many years maybe to do it. And I promptly lost my agent, lost my publisher. People think it's like an Oprah story. When I start telling this, they're going to say, oh, you followed your bliss and look what happened. No, it was my Jerry Maguire moment. I lost everything. So I went from up here, and 5 minutes after I decided what I was going to do, I was 7 figures in debt and had no deal, you know. And I was off the shelf for 5 years. Sounds funny, but 5 years off the shelf can kill you in any business, man. And nobody knew what would happen. And then about 2 weeks before Natchez Burning comes out, Twitter was new then, and a tweet comes out and it says, Natchez Burning, best thriller in years, Ken Follett. And I turned to my wife and I said, that ain't the real Ken Follett. There's just no way. But it was. And that kind of started everything.
How did that happen? How did he find it, you know?
I've never been able to find that out. I haven't even talked to him. He's tweeted a couple more things.
Do you do Twitter?
Yeah, I do now. All right. My wife wants to try to slap it out of my
hand. You follow
hand.
Ken Follett?
Yeah. No, I don't. Why'd you put me down on that? You're pinning me down. I will start in the night.
So in 2011, you were going to get paint. Weren't you going to look at paint?
Going to look at paint colors at my new house. How was that for a momentous quest to nearly die?
And you're a week from deadline on the Natchez Burning book, which you think is going to be one and done.
I knew then it couldn't, but I was in irate discussions, you know, with my publisher.
And you said, you know, you're saying you were pulling punches until that moment. Why? What were you pulling, and what were the forces?
You know, I write the kind of books that it's often said you need to wait till certain people die before you can write the book. You know what I mean? They're so close to reality that it'd be better if certain people were dead before you told the story. So I've always walked a fine line with what I'm telling and revealing secrets and brushing up against reality. So you tend to be cautious when you're doing that. Second, if you're writing about family or friends, I mean, Natchez is a small place. One of the most shocking things to people.
How big is it, by the way?
When I grew up, it was 25,000, but now it's just 15, like this, shrinking like all Mississippi towns. The shocking thing for people is they go like, oh my God, this guy, he used to coach me in Little League, or I used to cut his grass, or whatever. We tend to compartmentalize evil and think, oh, it's over here. It's like when I wrote about child abuse. We all want to tell ourselves child abuse is happening out in the trailer on the edge of town, not in the minister of music's house next door to us in the nice suburb, man, but it's happening everywhere. And so the kind of evil we talk about in here, it was just regular guys, you know? Right. It's not...
You're talking about the bad guys in the book. People would say, oh, he used to cut my lawn.
Sure, that kind of thing. Or I used to cut his lawn, or he used to throw the ball to me. And I mean, it's that old thing. I've written across many, many genres. If you look up here at me, here's what makes me different from everybody you'll see who comes through here. I've written books set in the Holocaust. I've written about artificial intelligence. I've written about child abuse. And I've written about the South. And they don't let you do that, generally. Publishers want you to, whatever makes them money, they want you to rewrite that book over and over again. The only way you get to do what I do is to make money, even though you're shooting yourself in the foot every time. You know, but what unites those books for me, all my books essentially are an inquiry into the nature of evil. Whether I'm writing about the Holocaust or about the civil rights movement or whatever it is, my quest is to understand why good people do bad things, why bad people do good things, why the line between good and evil runs right down the middle of the human heart, you know? Mm-hmm. Faulkner's old verities. I mean, That's what we all want to know. People ask me, we're going to talk later about the band I'm in, and one of the members is Stephen King. They ask me, like Steve, where do you get these sick ideas? Where do you come up with all this? And I give them a knowing look and say, you ain't fooling me, man. Every person in this room is a human being. Every person in this room has some weird ideas and has done some pretty bad things. That's life, man. So why? That's what I write about, you know?
For the audience, what novel should we read? You said that was kind of too close to reality, you know, that they might want to pick up that would be better off if everyone were dead before you.
I mean, oh, God.
What do you mean by that?
There's a little of that sprinkled through most of my Mississippi books, you know. I'll segue onto something that I really believe I tell people, and it brushes up against that. The only current, I'll tell you a secret most writers don't say. Every writer of fiction is writing about himself or herself, everyone. If they tell you they're not, they're either lying or they're so deep in denial they don't even know they're lying. But they have to be, because you can't make this junk up and move people. You can make stuff up, but it's not going to cut people to the quick. The only currency we have as writers or any kind of artist is insight. It's the thing that brings you to that point in the book where you just go, oh my God, I felt that my whole life, but I've never been able to express it. Or I've looked at that my whole life, but I've never looked at it quite that way. So what gives an artist the ability to do that? Insight. And how do we get insight? Only one way Homo sapiens get insight: suffering. That's it. Anybody with a kid in here knows that. You can tell a kid anything you want a million times and they're never gonna get it. They touch that stove one time, they got it. And that applies to everything, okay? So all of us, artists, have got a limited amount of suffering that we lived and a limited amount of insight. And I feel like I got this little bag on my belt, little leather bag of nuggets that I've learned. And I dole them out very reluctantly as I write these books because I know I'm running out. I've written 16 books now. But here's how I know I'm right. When I put one of those in, I can disguise it, lie about it, change the name, whatever. But a year after I do it, the emails start coming in when the book comes out. And the emails come from China, Brazil, New Zealand, Traverse City, Czechoslovakia, it doesn't matter. And they all say the same thing. Dear Mr. Isles, I've never written a writer before, but on the bottom of page 275 in this book, I started crying. Now, they're all writing about the exact same passage. They're all writing about one of those little nuggets I took out of the bag. And why is that? Because I don't care if they're from China or New Zealand or whatever. They all had parents. They all had their heart broken. They all been betrayed. Every human being everywhere is exactly the same, full stop. And we all recognize that pain. And so that's what I'm talking about. When you say brushing up against reality, I'm not just saying, oh, I'm telling real stories that are secrets, but I'm telling them the painful kernel at the heart of that secret. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people might know the secret, but for whatever reason, I saw how it fit into everything mm-hmm. and felt it with my own pain.
The nugget might be loss of a family member, heartbreak.
Yeah.
Those kinds of
interracial experience. Relationship.
Right.
Anything. You just, you know.
I had never thought of it like that before. So you might hold back on a book and say, I'm not going to go to
absolutely.
Heart.
Absolutely. Really? I did it a lot more then. After the accident, when you realize, hey, I could have been dead yesterday, then you say, why am I keeping these nuggets in my bag? I mean, I'm going to die with them in my bag, right? So you just say, okay, well, I hope I get some more, you know? And the accident gave me some more, frankly. I mean, you know, I learned a lot nearly dying and coming back.
What's the thing you learned the most?
What my man Stephen King said through Morgan Freeman in Shawshank Redemption: get busy living or get busy dying. Sorry to be so heavy, man, but, you know, anyway.
Well, look at the time.
I found my brother from another mother here on this trip. We got so much in common, it's like scary, man. But we'll leave that out of this.
Yeah, I've written more books than Greg. In the time he wrote three books, I've written one book. Yeah. Wow, that's moving. You talk about Faulkner a little bit about, and if you, I pulled open Absalom, 2 days ago because I knew I read it in college. And if you haven't gone to Faulkner lately, it's funny up here how we don't read into that tradition, that Southern tradition. It's very different. I lived in Louisiana for a couple of years, and hearing you tell stories is great. But Quentin Compson is a character in. Are you doing anything with Quentin Avery and Quentin Compson?
There's a little homage in the name there, and the whole Quentin, I hate the South thing. I hate it, or I don't hate it, you know. But that's really complicated for this short discussion.
Well, what I mean is how up here we have Hemingway.
Yeah.
I told you earlier, the In Our Time stories, which are as monumental as Fire, Light in August.
Sure.
But we don't really respond to Hemingway in that way. Do you feel that you have to, as a Southern writer, deal with Faulkner? And what are the traditions of Southern storytelling that we might not know about?
Here's the thing. I get asked all the time about that, being a Southern writer, the Southern tradition. Why does Mississippi have so many great writers? And there are a lot of glib answers you can give to that. I came out of a little program at Ole Miss that was taught by Willie Morris, who edited Harper's in New York. And Willie had friends that he published, like William Styron and James Dickey and John Knowles and Winston Groom and people like that. And you get to know about the tradition through them, and you always get viewed through it. But here's the essence of Southern literature to me, especially now. Well, I meant to say, though, by the way, out of that little program, I came out of there, Donna Tartt came out of that, John Grisham came out of that, quite a few writers from this one little period. But it's this. When I get off the interstate in these towns on book tour, not Traverse City so much, but most anywhere else, everywhere looks the same. Everywhere smells the same. People talk the same. Everywhere is the little fake mall built to look like America in 1910. And there's a P.F. Chang and a Bonefish Grill and a blah, 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 whatever. It's all the same, okay? You get off the interstate in Mississippi, you know you somewhere. Okay? It's about 1971 in Mississippi today, okay? And that's a good thing for writers because everywhere has its setting and all that, but the South, one journalist did a great thing about the civil rights movement, and he had one sentence I never forgot. He said, the extra molecule of air in Mississippi is fear. You know, there's a density there, and look, where I live, hey man, I live there. The guy I know down the street, you say, where's your mama from? She's from there, and her mama's from there, and her mama's mama's from there, and it goes back 6, 7, 8 generations. That kind of density going through families and the land and across black and white and people owning the land all the way back, it's just, you can't separate it, and the stories come out of that. You know, it's a rural, backward place in so many ways. Right. And so storytelling is just the thing. I mean, up here in the North, that things were industrial, things were oriented toward progress. In an agricultural, feudal world, progress is not the thing. The guys with money, they're not trying to get progress. They just want a little more land and a little more money and a few more slaves.
Right.
And that, a lot of ways, that's not a good thing, but it's a good thing for storytelling.
Right. You know, it's funny, Time Magazine, I got the new issue in the mail, opened it up, and there's a thing about, in 1972, Mississippi PBS banned Sesame Street for 22 episodes because it had a mixed cast. And that was in 71 or 2. That's bizarre to me.
Buddy, 2 weeks ago, I was on a radio show in Mississippi while the legislature's trying to ban PBS in Mississippi right now. Ban it.
Right.
I mean, Trump's got nothing on the Mississippi legislature, man. These guys don't shoot themselves in the foot. They're trying to shoot themselves in the head ever since they did it. I said this. I get myself in trouble. Last time I said this, somehow I wound up on like a Fox-affiliated radio show, and the governor was in the green room while I was talking. And at the end, the host made the mistake of saying, so, Greg, you got any final thoughts? And I knew I'm like, yeah, as a matter of fact, I got a few thoughts. Let me talk to the governor here. Anyway, I'm going to shut up before I get in more trouble.
Well, we went there, but you did, you know, you've published those books. You're in 20 different countries. So millions of, so you've done all this other kind of writing. Tell, the audience is really, we're really interested in how you just do what you do, aside from these more heavier subjects. I mean,
the process part is, I'm clinically insane. I feel weird just talking about myself, but playing in this band with other writers has been a blessing because you find out a lot about other writers' process too. And I know about, say, John Grisham's process. I did a show with John years ago and people asked us about process. And for John, a good day for him, average day's 3 pages, good day's 4 pages, and he writes the first page of his next book on the day he finishes his last book. And I would advise you to follow that method because he's a lot richer than I am. Okay? Now, my method is quite different from that. And this, if there's a shrink in the audience, he may commit me after I tell this story. All right, here's what I do. I go most of the year doing nothing, number one. And when the publisher calls nervously, how's it going? Great, going good. And I don't mean I'm telling them I got 30 chapters and I really got 15. I got nothing. I hadn't even started typing. And they paid me, you know, a year ago. Here's what I'm doing. I'm working passively. Now, that sounds like something your teenager tells you, right? But I figured something out that Stephen King put better than anybody else in On Writing, his great book on writing. He said, a writer's mind is like a house. And he said, the subconscious is the basement of the house. And down in the subconscious are a whole bunch of crates. And there are no labels on the crates. And the worst thing you can do as a writer is try to go down in that basement and sort out those crates. You know why? Because there's already a crew down there working on those crates. And your job is to stay the hell out of the way. Now, I figured that out before Steve ever told me that by just doing it. Here's what I do. I'm coaching my kids' little league team. I'm playing music. I'm doing whatever I'm doing. The story's working itself out inside without getting pretentious all Jungian way, you know, like antagonist, protagonist, shapeshifter, trickster, all that is happening, but you don't think about it. You don't slap note cards on the wall and colored thread. You just, it's happening. It's this stew in there. And then one day, pardon me, ladies, but it's like a pregnant lady when her water breaks, man. That story is coming no matter what. Then I got to run to my lazy boy where I got the hospital table and the monitors and my cold six packs of Tab and my granola bars. And I start writing minimum 10 hours a day. Last third of the book, I write 24 hours at a time, sometimes 36 hours at a time, and crash. Good day for me is 30 pages, and I almost never change a word. My point is this. If you've done what Steve said, and if you've thought about it sufficiently, and the story has come to where it should be, it's almost like taking dictation. What I say is command of the English language is like nothing. It's just like a bag with a hammer and nails and glue and a level or whatever. Command of the English language has got very little to do with being a novelist, okay? If command of the English language was it, all these professors out here at these colleges would have million-dollar book deals. Or it's like singing. If I tell you I can sing, which I'm going to do in a second, how many seconds do I have to sing before you know if I can sing or not? 4 seconds? Writing is just the same. You think it's not the same because you can write a letter. You can write a sermon. You can write a legal brief. It's got nothing to do with storytelling, okay? Nothing. It's just like the singer at the church down here. If it was talent, if it was command of the talent, then all those soloists at Ebenezer Baptist would have a record deal. They don't, okay? It's about something inherently different, and I think it's something you're born with, and if you're not born with it, you get it by the time you're 8 years old. Puberty tops, certainly Bree's age out here who read the little story. She's either a writer or she's not right now, and it sounded to me like she is, okay? How do I know? I can read one sentence, maybe three. Now, beginning writers think, when they send in, like the books say, you know, send in a query letter in 3 chapters, how can they possibly judge my work with just 1 chapter, 3 chapters? Look, you'll be lucky if they read 1 chapter. You'll be lucky if they read 1 page. So what can I tell by reading 1 page, right? It's simple. I can read one sentence. I may not know where you're going, but I know you know where you're going, and I trust you to take me there. You better have that down, because they're never going to get any further than that if you don't. Now, that's enough about process for me.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Coming up in the second half, more of Doug Stanton's conversation with Greg Iles.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to my conversation with Greg Iles, author of Mississippi Blood, the third book in his Natchez Burning trilogy.
You talked about being in the band, the Rock Bottom Remainders.
Yeah. Bunch of overrated writers, sad.
Who's in the band? Tell us who this is.
Some minimal talent folks. Stephen King, Amy Tan, Scott Turow, Dave Barry, Ridley Pearson, Mitch Albom, Roger McGuinn of the Byrds, Matt Groening from The Simpsons. It's a pretty stellar cast. Scott Turow, right, background chick singer. Wears a dress and an afro while we perform. Amy Tan wears, she's our rhythm dominatrix. Amy wears fishnet stockings and a bodysuit and whips us on the ass while singing, "These boots are made for walking." Alcohol mandatory, put it that way. Not for kids at all. As Dave Barry says, we play music about as well as Metallica writes novels. That covers it.
And what do you guys do? Do you play at function?
Well, we used to tour twice a year. We do it for charity, for children's literacy, but as Amy Tan has said, don't give us any credit because this is so much fun, we'd kill whales to be able to do this. But, you know, we usually get underwritten by somebody like Verizon or somebody, and they sell tickets, and we get to do really fun stuff like Google headquarters, but sometimes we'll do like House of Blues or colleges, and it's just a train wreck, and women throw geriatric underwear, and we charge a bunch of money, and, you know, that's it. That's the gig.
Would you play us a song? You guys want to hear Greg play a song?
Oh, boy. See if I can do this without falling down. Y'all, if I stand up through the whole song, y'all cheer, okay? Now, I'm supposed to turn up this amp to 10 o'clock, I believe, right? Sound man, Joe? Now, in the band, I gotta say, the talent level is marginal. But some of us really were musicians before we were writers. The year I stopped to write Spandau Phoenix, my first book, I had been a musician. I toured 50 weeks out of 52 that year and made like 30 grand. And I realized, this ain't gonna work right here. But I didn't want to get a real job. I didn't want to go to law school. So I gave myself 1 year to write a best-selling novel. And I did it, thank goodness. So
that was Spandau Ballet.
He's drunk, forgive him, Spandau Phoenix.
Oh.
I got him. So the real musicians are Ridley Pearson, myself, and Mitch Albom. And Dave Barry played in a band in college called the Federal Duck. That gives you an idea. Now, mostly we do like rock and roll covers, and sometimes we do something really fun, like I got to do Blue Oyster Cult, Don't Fear the Reaper with Stephen King, singing it and yelling more cowbell while I was playing the solo. That's the surreal kind of moment you can't pay money to get, right? So this little tune I'm going to play you is kind of a takeoff, a braggadocio takeoff I did on James Taylor's Steamroller Blues, because when I got in the band, they said, you know, you want to do Steamroller Blues? Or when I said, yeah. So I rewrote it for the writing business. And James Taylor has told the story many times. You know, people take that's not a serious blues song. It was sort of a parody because all the people when James was coming up would, you know, try to be legit blues and write these songs like, I'm a dump truck, I'm a this, that. So he wrote Steamroller, and of course the predominantly white audience accepted it as some kind of legit blues song. So here we go. I hadn't played this since the last Remainders gig, which was a while. So I'm going to do the intro, and then I'm going to reach in my pocket clumsily and get the pick out. Well, I'm a big bestseller, baby. Shakespeare ain't got squat on me. Yes, I'm a big bestseller, baby. It's all about the royalty. I write a book a year forever. When I die posthumously, I'm a big bestseller, baby. William Faulkner's just a bomb. I'm a big bestseller, baby. Hollywood, gon' give me some. Give me some love, Matthew McConaughey. And if you wanna save a million trees, just download me from Amazon. Now, normally I have a little verse about James Patterson here, but I'm gonna leave that out. I don't want to get sued. I think this goes on NPR. So we're going to skip to the next verse. And normally I have Amy Tan standing just to my right in a bodysuit while I sing this verse. So try to imagine that, okay, when I come to the punchline. I'm a bold, erotic novel. The kind of book they used to ban. Ladies peel back my brown wrapper, and then they read me with one hand. But 50 Shades of Grey is so passe, I've got 100 shades of tan. I'm a big bestseller, baby. I got numbers, I got class. I'm a big bestseller, baby. All that rejection's in my past. What I really wanna say here today is all you critics kiss my ass. I really wanna say here today is all you critics kiss my ass. It seems I'll lately, baby, got myself a bad, bad case of those big bestseller blues.
Okay,
that's hard to do after a week of having the flu, but I tried it, so please say on NPR I was sick. Thank you.
Wow, how do we follow that? I mean, there in a nutshell.
One more drink.
The funny thing is you decided that being a musician was too hard, so you thought, I'll just be a novelist instead.
Well, that goes with what I was saying, though. I really believe it, that You go through life trying to find the thing you're supposed to be doing, right? And writing's a funny thing because so many people want to do it. I'm gonna tell a little funny here. I hate doing it and I hate being discouraging, but so many people tell you they want to write a book, and you want to be encouraging. The people I always take seriously are the ones who tell me they are writing a book. You know, they're halfway. Not the ones who say, "I got this story. I got to tell you. Man, you just, all you got to do is write it and you can have half the money. That's all you got to do." But Mark Twain said something apropos, better than anybody else. Somebody said, "Mr. Twain, you know, they say everybody has a story inside them." And Mark Twain thought a second and he said, "You know, that's true, and that's usually the best place for it." So anyway, the whole thing about being a writer, what I'm saying is, yeah, when I sat down 10 years after college to write a best-selling novel to keep from getting a real job, the last thing I'd written was my term paper on Elvis when I was 22 at Ole Miss. And but that's just because along the way, people would pull me aside. And I remember, always remember this professor, who's a friend now. At the time, he was just a professor. He goes, "Mr. Isles, would you stay after class?" I'm like, "Oh, God, what have I done now?" And he pulls me in there, and he's nervous. He goes, "I just want you to know you can write, right?" I'm like, "Yeah, okay, thanks." And I left. And I mean, to me, I didn't see how that was going to get me a date with the girl I wanted to go out with or anything. Playing guitar was way better than for that, right? So writing was just something I could do. Right. I'm not even saying, "Oh, wow, I'm bragging, I can write." That's why I said it's like singing. Or you're the best deer hunter, or you're a genius with wood, or whatever your thing is, man. You either do it or you don't do it.
Right. You know? Yeah, you said earlier we were talking, I said, "How do you work so much?" You know, you wrote the trilogy in 8 years?
8 years, yeah.
I mean, that, and 2,300 pages.
750,000 words. That's the suicidal number right there.
Wow. And you said, "Well, it's not work. I don't think of writing as work." And that's really a great place to be.
Well,
were you born that way? I mean, when you were 8 years old.
No, I'm lazy. I
don't believe you. First of all, I'm still stuck on the lazy boy with the six-pack of tab. And tell us what that looks like. Where's your lazy place?
My wife would tell you that's an ugly scene right there. Me, lazy boy right now is in the kitchen because it's too hard to get down to my office with my, I don't want to put on my prosthetic when I wake up and I got some idea. I got to get down, right? I don't want to fool with that. So I like take my wheelchair, run in there to where the lazy boy is. Now, here's how idiotic I am. My old lazy boy rig, I thought it was time to update it. So I find this guy in Chicago who builds like desks for handicapped people. He builds me this thing that looks like you could fly 3 space shuttles and take out North Korea, right? Multiple monitors and a big electric chair and all this stuff. And I don't use it because it's one flight of stairs down. I still set up my lazy boy at my hospital table like right off the kitchen, you know, and take over the whole house. But here's my point about process is this. I want to get this across to anybody in the crowd. Everybody asks about process. Do you write longhand? Do you write with a computer? You write in the morning? You write at night? Forget it. What does that matter? That doesn't matter at all. There's no clue in that for you, okay? Donna Tartt wrote The Secret History over 7 years longhand. Peter Straub writes with black wing pencils. I know people who do put 500 note cards on the wall and colored thread going everywhere. The whole point is what comes out of the other end of the pipe. It don't matter what goes in the pipe or how you do it. Or all that matters is what hits the page, full stop.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I agree. I think, though, I had never heard of the Lazy Boy rig. And I'd like...
I may start marketing that, like trademark it. You know? Make a deal with Lazy Boy. Bring him back. You know, make it chic.
You know, but you're... Yeah, but you know, I think you're, I mean, not everyone, so, but not everyone could do that because left to their own devices, sitting in a chair, they'd fall asleep. So I guess.
You want to know what it looks like? I used to listen to music while I do it. Oh, one of the coolest things ever happened the other day. This shows you how getting a little bit of success is cool. I get obsessed with a certain piece of music, or now actually watch movies while I'm writing. When I wrote Devil's Punch Bowl, I watched Michael Clayton about 400 times in a row. It's like a background loop going on right in front of my face, but it just off axis, right? But music, I listen to this piece, is so good I actually put it in a book. It's in The Bone Tree, and it's, I don't know how you say it, Capriccio Primo. It's like the best cello piece ever, and it's played by this woman named Eleanor Fry. So I'm on tour the other day in like Kentucky or somewhere, and I look on Twitter, and Eleanor Fry is following me on Twitter. I'm like, what the heck? So I direct message her, and I'm like, you're my goddess, you know? What in the world are you doing following me on Twitter? So somebody in Nova Scotia reads The Bone Tree, who's Eleanor Fry's friend, screenshots it, sends it to her. She starts following me on Twitter. Now she's sending me all her records, and I'm sending her all my books, man. That's like, you know, that's the cool part about success.
Wow.
Sorry to digress.
I didn't know that you watch the movies while you're writing books. I mean, it's I listen to music really loud, you know, as a way to kind of distract.
Stephen King does that. Same song over and over and over and over.
Really?
Yeah.
How do you, you also said something interesting, you don't really revise a lot. Greg, how do you get it?
My agent doesn't like me to say that. Because it makes other writers go, why do I have to change it? But that's my thing. I think it comes from being a musician.
Yeah.
You know, being a songwriter a little bit. For me, writing is very, very rhythmic. You know, I've had fights with editors where, back in the days when they would suggest some change and say, we shorten the sentence a little bit and put it like this, do you think there's any difference? And I'm like, are you brain damaged? Have you read that sentence out loud? Do you got the rhythm of that? You know, because like you said, out loud, it's all rhythm, words, man, fall. You look at that big fat artifact here and it looks like a thing, right? It looks like, oh, well, look at this big book. Man, you process this just like a film, one word at a time, one frame at a time, running through your brain. That's where the illusion is built, one word at a time. And there's a rhythm even silently in the head while the eye perceives those words, mm-hmm. I think. And so for me, that's why I do it 30 pages at a time. I got to live it while it's happening. If you're writing about murder and sex and race and all this junk, you can't sit there and calculate it and think about it and polish it. It's just, you just got to get mm-hmm. it out, you know?
How do you wind down, though? This was, you know, this book deals with...
That's not a G-rated discussion. That's like music, man. You get done with the gig at 2 a.m., you're like, whoa, God, wow. Everybody else is going to bed, and, you know, that leads to bad things. I'm an old musician, you know. I'm not trying to be funny. That's, you know, that's it. I'm throwing him off his game, but he needs it.
No, I'll just listen. I'm fine. this was some tough stuff to write. And I know you're being honest. I know you're putting it out there. But really, you pulled this out of some deep place. Why I'm bringing this up is this is fiction, but it reads like news.
You want to know how real this gets?
I'll tell you Stanley something. Stanley is alive.
I'll tell you something I've never said in an interview ever, and I'll tell you in this room. You know, some of you seen the Emmett Till picture of Emmett Till's corpse where his head's like this big? Horrible. All right. The guy that Albert Norris, Natchez Burning opens with Albert Norris, who owns a music store, being burned out. In real life, that was a guy named Frank Morris, who owned a shoe shop. Now, like in the book, Frank didn't die right away. He lived 3 or 4 days. And he was when he ran out of his store, he was naked except the waistband of his pants. Underwear, because everything burned off. And he got all the way to the emergency room, and the nurse remembers to this day a trail of bloody footprints from the door to the treatment room. And he was in a coma after a while, but for a few days he wasn't, and everybody from the FBI to his best friend, he saw the guys who did it to him. He never would tell who did it, because he knew what would happen if he did. He wouldn't just die, but
maybe
his family.
This was 67?
God,
in the 60s.
Yeah, I don't even know the exact year because I blend my fiction with the fact so much. But here's the thing. He's being guarded by cops who are in the Klan. A couple of his friends, you know, managed to get in there, but he won't tell them. And a guy sneaks in there who was a Catholic priest who was black. You talk about cojones. This guy sneaked a camera in the room. Nobody's ever seen this picture publicly. He shot a picture of Frank lying in hospital bed, and there's a black nurse beside him with her hands like this. Just the hands would make a award-winning photo. But Frank, when you see him in a picture, alive and normal, he's a handsome guy with a thin face. And in that bed, his head's the size of a watermelon. And he is alive. He's not dead like Emmett Till. And you take a look at that for a few seconds, and it'll bring you down to earth real quick, what you're dealing with on something like this. Now, but I'm not gonna make it easy on you guys. I'm gonna tell you what's at the core of this book for me. And the last 2 years have really put the nail in this for people. It's made people wake up. When I started writing Natchez Burning, people were starting to talk about America being a post-racial society. And I worried that these books would be irrelevant, you know, that I'd waited too late to begin this inquiry into this. Now, I don't think there's one person in North America who'd argue we live in a post-racial society. But if the events of the last 2 years have proved anything, is that racism is not a Southern problem. It is not a sectional problem. It is an American problem. In the South, racism was always bad, but it was overt. It happened right in front of your face. It was not hypocritical. It was not hidden. That's why people from James Brown to Charles Evers, brother of Medgar, to Martin Luther King have all said they would trust a Southerner over a Northerner many times because they knew what they were dealing with, and they knew if that guy told him he would do something, he would do it. Whereas in the North, in D.C., a guy would smile, pat him on the back, and then turn around and stab him in the back. Okay? Now, here's what I'll tell you. There were single counties in Mississippi, single counties that had more black people than 7-8 Northern states put together. It's easy to pontificate about an issue when you don't know anything about it. It'd be like people in Natchez telling y'all what to do about Native American issues up here. We don't know anything about it, nothing, okay? So racism seemed like a Southern problem until the migrations, when blacks moved north and started looking for pay, housing, and education. And then racism became a problem real quick. But something happened in 64 that tells the tale. 1964, Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman go missing in Neshoba County. Biggest manhunt in the history of America begins for those three bodies, or boys. Day 19, two guys wash up in the offshoot of the Mississippi River on the other side of the state. For about 12 hours, communications go crazy between the FBI field office in Jackson and D.C. because they thought it might be the bodies. Then forensically, they determine it's two black guys in their 20s. As soon as they determine that, spotlight goes off, all attention goes back to Neshoba County, and it's 40 years before they solve the murder of those two guys who were killed by the Silver Dollar Group in my book. Now, is that because people were apathetic in Mississippi that it took 40 years to solve that case? FBI practically was in charge of the whole state. Yeah, people in Mississippi were apathetic. Where people were also apathetic in Albany, New York, in Los Angeles, California, in St. Louis, and everywhere else. The reason they cared about what happened in Neshoba County was because two of those boys were white college students, period. So this issue of race is the thorniest issue in America. It is the wound in America's side. And right now, I don't even see the answer to it. I hope I have contributed a little, just a little bit, but we got a long, long way to go. And I'm not here to preach to you, man, but it's a problem. Mm-hmm. So anyway.
Should we bring up the lights and say hi to each other and take some questions from the audience?
Let's do it. Be brave. Throw them out.
Greg, I almost hate to ask this question, but it has to be asked. Uh-oh. What's next up for you?
You know, we've been talking about that for about 2 days. I was writing a thing. This audience is old enough to remember Double Indemnity with Fred McMurray and Barbara Stanwyck. I was writing a sort of Double Indemnity story set in Oxford, Mississippi, where I went to college, home of Faulkner and, you know, Grisham and everybody, a lot of good writers. But the response to this trilogy has been so big. And I'm suddenly, like I said, I mean, I go places and they say, this is the next Pat Conroy, or this is William Faulkner for the Breaking Bad generation, or whatever. Who knows whatever that means, but all I know is, suddenly I have this audience and this chance. And I'm not sure what I need to do is go backward to something conventional. I need to take a breath and think about what I'm going to do next. And I don't know what that is, you know?
Who wants to see him continue the Mississippi Blood Trilogy? Yeah.
Thank you.
Why chapter 25 in The Quiet Game?
The prose for one paragraph, two paragraphs, it's as good as anything. It's, you know, I'm brutally honest about my writing. You know, I got a hunt in the trilogy to find something I would just say word to word, this is beautiful. But I can go to The Quiet Game and open almost any page and it's good. And the beginning of chapter 25 is just poetry.
Right.
You know, if anybody's got a Kindle in here, I'll read it, but I don't know. Anyway.
It's for sale in the lobby, by the way, too. Yes,
grab it in the lobby. I can read one paragraph. He asked me to read, and I don't have anything.
Yeah, somebody go get The Quiet Game if it's out in the lobby.
It's worth reading. I kid you not. All right, somebody asked a good question. Pressure's on.
I don't know. But anyway, did you ever consider leaving the South? And is your wife a Southerner?
Yes, my wife is a Southerner. I'm on my second wife, and they're both Southerners. And for the first time, I'm considering leaving Natchez. I've never thought about it before. But I'm 50. When I started writing this trilogy, I was 49. I had two legs. I felt young. I turned 57 the other day. I got one leg. I look like Santa Claus. I'm tired, man, you know? And I've been fighting to try to change my hometown and save it. And you guys don't know how lucky you are having people like Doug and Ann here and doing these things, you know, these cultural things.
Well,
I try to do this at home, and there's just not enough critical mass of people like me or my wife or people I went to school with. They don't live there anymore. They live in Nashville and Dallas and St. Louis and wherever. They don't live in Natchez. And after a while, it gets discouraging, man. You know, I don't want to whine. I'm pretty resilient, but I'm getting tired. And we've been looking for houses in, like, Charleston and different places. Traverse City. He took me out to the lake today, man. I dug it out there. It was cool. Okay, here we go. So when people say you're the next Pat Conroy or Faulkner and all that, I just laugh and say that's ridiculous. But like this little bit, this is when I read something like this, I think what I really need to do is take enough time, like him, 7 years on a book, and let the whole book read like this is about to read. Okay. Einstein said the arrow of time flies only in one direction. Faulkner, being from Mississippi, understood the matter differently. He said the past is never dead. It's not even past. All of us labor in webs spun long before we were born, webs of heredity and environment, of desire and consequence, of history and eternity. Haunted by wrong turns and roads not taken, we pursue images perceived as new, but whose provenance dates to the dim dramas of childhood, which are themselves but ripples of consequence echoing down the generations. The quotidian demands of life distract from this resonance of images and events, but some of us feel it always. And who among us, given the chance, would not relive the day or hour in which we first knew love or ecstasy, or made a choice that forever altered our future, negating a life we might have had? Such chances are rarely granted. Memory and grief prove Faulkner right enough, but Einstein knew the finality of action. If I cannot change what I had for lunch yesterday, I certainly cannot unmake a marriage, erase the betrayal of a friend, or board a ship that left port 20 years ago. And yet, today I am granted such a chance.
Wow.
That was Greg Iles talking with Doug Stanton. Greg Iles' latest book is Mississippi Blood, the third in his Natchez Burning Trilogy. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org and listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.